Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Bruce Jamison here on behalf of the appellant W.R. Huff Asset Management Co. With me at council table is Edward Dartley, counsel to W.R. Huff. He has been admitted pro hac vice and will be making the presentation this morning.
Thank you. Welcome to the Court.
Thank you, Your Honors. As Mr. Jamison said, my name is Ed Dartley. I am in-house counsel with W.R. Huff. My intention here today is not to go over the facts or our arguments in the briefs, as I think we've set them out concisely in our papers. What I wanted to do today was just make a few points that I think are important for the Court to consider as it considers this issue and the papers. I think it's important that the Court look at this issue from the perspective of what actually happened in this corporate transaction. No matter how you look at it, PetroHawk acquired KCS in a substantive change of control whereby PetroHawk was the surviving company and PetroHawk's board of directors constituted a majority of the directors post-merger. The directors and officers of KCS got change of control payments under their change of control agreements. Now, those change of control agreements read differently, and they are change of control agreements which are directly negotiated between the D's and O's and the company.
Is that legally relevant? I mean, it may be an equity in your favor, but is it legally relevant to the analysis that we need to undertake?
It's not directly relevant. I think the substance of the transaction combined with the policy considerations that I think are at issue here, indentures, I think, are in a class apart from other types of commercial contracts. They are standardized. There is some variation between terms, but there's a consistency among the terms that have been used in literally thousands of indentures. And investors in the capital markets, whether it's in a primary offering or in a secondary offering, look to those terms for predictability and uniformity.
And what is the standardized contract, indenture contract form? The two that you cited to us in your brief?
The forms that we cited to in our brief, I think, have taken some variation over the years. I have seen, in terms of the definition of company, I have seen the definition of company where it is defined strictly as the issuer, and I've seen the definition of company where it is defined to include the successor language that the appellee would like to have this court infer into the definition. In fact, in the merger transaction itself, PetroHawk issued new notes in which, in that case, they defined the company as the company and any successors. That's in connection with the acquisition of KCS.
The notable feature of your argument about standardized contracts is that if you're correct, then that gives your argument a leg up in terms of what the parties intended. That is, if the uniform, universal global intent as evidenced by the standard form is that company is either defined as the company or the company and its successor, and since this agreement doesn't include successor in the definition, ergo, the only company for purposes of the indenture, or at least the provision at issue here, would be KCS.
I think that's right. I think intent is...
But is there anything in the record to support your contention concerning... that is, that there are, in effect, standard forms?
In this record, no. I think that there are enough cases out there that have recognized that fact. Sharon Steele, for instance, which is a case that was cited by both Vice Chancellor Strine and by the appellees. Sharon Steele, actually, as I was preparing for this oral argument, was a case that had I written my briefs again, I would have cited in my brief, because I think, and I would urge the court to read that case. as I'm sure it will, it's 691 F2D 1039. Sharon Steele, I think, is important because it identifies the policy considerations that I was speaking of. It identifies the reality that indentures are standardized agreements wherein the participants in the capital markets look to those agreements for some level of uniformity and predictability so that they can make business decisions about whether to invest, whether to loan money to a company without having to worry about the uncertainties of whether this provision is going to mean something different than the way they read it. And when you inject unpredictability into the reading of these provisions, you have a situation where prospective investors are going to look at that provision, be uncertain as to what its meaning, and that's necessarily, I think, going to increase borrowing costs because increased risk in interpretation is going to mean increased risk in your investment. And that actually is this particular case sort of exemplifies that point. Whereas when this transaction was announced and when you read this provision, you read company as the company, you come to the conclusion that there's a change of control.
What is a permitted successor? That basically means a friendly acquisition or something else?
I don't know that it means necessarily a friendly acquisition. I think the words mean what it means. The friendly acquisition versus hostile takeover point that Judge Strine relied on was nowhere in the record, and frankly is something that, in my experience, I've never heard raised, as a basis for the change of control provision or any other provision in the indentures that I've reviewed.
Would you agree that Petrohawk was a permitted successor?
In what sense? Because permitted successor is not in the definition of company. I mean, I agree that Petrohawk, by virtue of the transaction, by virtue of the its supplemental indenture it executed, succeeded to the obligations of KCS. Now, I say that, and I say at the same time that there was language in that supplemental indenture that was put into there specifically to preserve our rights to enforce and challenge the company's denial of the change of control.
Is that a yes, that Petrohawk is a permitted successor?
Within the parameters that I just articulated, yes, it is a successor of KCS. The other point that I wanted to focus on this morning was on the issue of what the continuing director definition means by nominated for election or elected. That is not a technicality to require that if there's going to be a situation where you have to look at whether there's a continuing director, that director be elected by the shareholders. As bondholders, we have very limited protection. Our protection is limited to what is in the indenture. We have contractual protections, and that's it. Shareholders have protections that arise from fiduciary duties of the directors and also from statute.
Well, with Mr. Dartley, as I understand the position of the other side, they're making two arguments. One is that it isn't necessary that the Delaware corporate governance scenario be followed in connection with the interpretation of a New York contract or a contract governed by New York law. But in any event, in substance, that is what happened. And as the argument goes, as far as I understand it, that if you have an election of directors, there are two elements, two substantive elements. One is that the directors are nominated, which they were here, by the boards of both constituent companies, and they are elected by shareholders. And here they were elected because the shareholders approved the merger agreement, which set forth in plain print who the directors of the successor company would be.
My answer to that point, Your Honor, is that approval of the merger agreement is not sufficient with respect to what the terms of the indenture say. The substance of the merger transaction was that the shareholders were being asked to approve a merger. Along with that, the...
And the terms of it.
One of
which was who the board of the successor company would be.
Not as a term. It was in the proxy statement. But bundling up those two questions is not fair from the perspective of what we bargained for in terms of what would trigger the change of control. The reason that I say that is that as bondholders, we invest in a company with a set of directors.
Well, before you get into that, you're arguing that the process that took place here doesn't constitute a nomination or election for purposes of the clause that's the continuing director definition. What would? That is, give us what scenario was called for, was required under this agreement, and how exactly would it have taken place?
Well, this is an unusual scenario, frankly. The concept of a company having a technical majority of the company shareholders acquiring a technical majority of the post-merger company but not having control of that board is a very unusual one. So it's not a scenario that...
Well, you haven't... What exactly was called for? Not, in your brief you say there had to be a process that, in effect... was modeled on the Delaware process for nominating and electing directors. That's easy to understand in the case of an ongoing corporation. But KCS was not going to be an ongoing corporation. So precisely what scenario do you contend had to be followed under this indenture in order for that the continuing director's provision to be operative?
Well, if we're talking about just the continuing directors now, and we're setting aside the definition of company, which I think raises separate issues, for the continuing director provision to be satisfied, there would have, pre-merger, had to have been an election by the shareholders of the board that was going to be constituted, that was going to constitute the post-merger board.
Well, so in other words, let me ask it this way. Given what in fact happened here, does your argument come down to the proposition that there had to be another box to be checked on the proxy? That is, the election before the merger took place, first an election of those directors, assuming there was an approval of the merger, and then secondly, an approval of the merger. Is that what we're talking about?
As a technical matter, that would be correct. I think that doesn't change the substantive point that it is appropriate under this indenture to interpret it to mean that the shareholders have to make and have to affirmatively approve the election of the indentures. It's not a technicality because, again, when we invest in a company, when a bondholder invests in a company and a set of directors who are the overseers of that company, and the overseers of that company can change membership under certain circumstances, meaning when one of their own nominates somebody else,
and then the shareholders. My question is yes. Basically,
the answer is yes.
Two boxes: one, a vote to take place before the merger, and then secondly, a vote to take place to determine if there were a merger that would have sufficed.
Yes. I guess what I'm saying is that you would unbundle those two issues, which is not uncommon in other contexts.
And you're saying that was required as a matter of New York law under this indenture provision.
What I'm saying is that with respect to the ability of the company to satisfy the continuing director provision, that would have been required.
Well, I'm looking at the continuing director's definition. It says, elected to such board of directors with the approval of a majority of the continuing directors who were members of such board at the time of such nomination or election. Didn't that happen?
No, it did not. The approval did, but the nomination election did not. And the way that the boards approved the directors, which was different than what was disclosed in the proxy statement, really goes to our argument with respect to the need for interpreting this indenture in a way that will give some certainty to what the process is. Because it wasn't until litigation ensued and tailored discovery was allowed on the specific point that bondholders found out exactly how the board was seated.
You're into your rebuttal time, which you're welcome to use, or you could save it.
I'll save it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. John Abramczyk appearing on behalf of Appalese. It's my pleasure this morning to introduce to the court Joe McLaughlin and George Kundis from the Simpson Thatcher Law Firm in New York.
Good morning. Welcome.
With the court's permission, Mr. McLaughlin will address the court this morning. He has been admitted pro hoc.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I recognize that the motion to intervene was granted, but before addressing the merits, with the court's permission, I'd like to very, very briefly address a development that became clear after the intervention was granted that really underscores the serious question of standing, threshold question of standing that remains in this case. Again, the indenture trustee that commenced this case and then filed the notice of appeal, as the court knows, abandoned the appeal because a majority of note holders refused to authorize it to proceed with the appeal. Now, we have the intervener on appeal, Huff Asset Management, admittedly is not a holder of any of the notes. It purports to be an investment manager, and I don't doubt that it is an investment manager, for more than 25% of the holders of the outstanding principal amount of the notes, none of which have been identified to the court. Now, this is the development. When Huff moved to intervene on appeal, it stated on page one of its motion that it was asking to be, quote, substituted for appellant law debenture, close quote, and then it confirmed, again on page one of its reply on that motion, that it was, quote, not seeking to pursue a separate individual action or individual remedies. That is, it was asking and was granted to be, it was saying that it was not intending to proceed on behalf of its individual clients or any of its individual financial clients, but in the shoes of the indenture trustee who had withdrawn. And then for the first time in its merits reply brief, Huff walked away from that representation and said that the only relief it seeks is for its individual accounts, not any other note holders. On page one of its reply brief, make no mistake about this, it says, quote, if this court reverses, it should order that appellees redeem the notes of W.R. Huff Asset Management Co. LLC's clients. So to put a fine point on it, Huff is not a note holder, but it's an investment advisor to certain note holders, and it's seeking individual relief. And the indenture very clearly addresses who has standing to sue. And it says basically that suits are to be brought by the trustee except in very limited circumstances that are set forth in Section 6.6 of the indenture, which is the so-called no-action clause. And that limits suits brought by people other than the trustee or note holders other than the trustee to situations where at least 25% of holders of the outstanding principal amount of the notes are bringing suit, and certain requirements are met, including one of which, number five, is that the holders of a majority in outstanding principal amount of the securities have not given the trustee a direction that, in the opinion of the trustee, is inconsistent with the request during a prescribed time period. Here we very clearly, the basis for their original intervention motion was that the more than 50% of the holders had declined to authorize the trustee to go forward, so they have no business being in this courtroom. But the court is interested in the merits, so with the court's permission, I'll now proceed to the merits. Yes.
I'm not sure that the new development that you're relying on, I'm not sure of the relationship of that to your standing argument. I thought what you were going to say is that when Huff did the about face and told us that it was seeking essentially a recovery on behalf of the note holders, the individual note holders, that was inconsistent with the relief that the trustee was seeking or would be able to seek. Do I have that wrong? That is, if the trustee were still in the case.
Right.
wouldn't the trustee be seeking the same thing, the same relief?
Yes, but he would be, but the trustee has not been authorized to proceed, and the standing provision of this indenture says that if a majority of the note holder speaks and says, stand down, the trustee is to stand down. That is the basis for the lack of standing for someone other than the trustee. I'll dispense with an extended version of the facts because I know the court is quite familiar with them, but I just wanted to emphasize up front that this indenture expressly permitted KCS to merge with and into another entity, provided the enumerated conditions of Section 5.1 were met. And the indenture is very clear in various places that a merger by itself doesn't trigger a change of control, even if KCS is not the surviving entity. Now, in the complaint, plaintiff alleged that the merger of PetroHawk and KCS triggered two of the circumstances defined as a change of control. The first was the voting stock provision, and the second, the continuing director provision. As you know, the voting stock provision is now out of the case, and they now make two arguments again, as below, in support of the contention that there was a triggered change of control under continuing director. The first relates to the contractual definition of the term company. Now, as the vice chancellor concluded, the basic construct of the indenture allows for a successor company following a merger without the survivor having to pay off the entire debt. And to suggest that it does not is really tantamount to saying that the indenture provides that any merger in which KCS is not the surviving entity triggers a change of control. Now, the Huff reading would have it that the term company means KCS only for all time, regardless of any subsequent transactions, including a merger that into which
Huff does have one very attractive, simple point, and that is that it would have been very easy to define the term company as including a successor company, and yet that wasn't done here, at least in the definition. In order to get to that result, it appears that your side has to rely on the supplemental indentures, which aren't even referenced in the definition, and then somehow expect an investor to read those two together in order to get to the result or to the definition that your side is relying on.
Well, there's no question that a way to do this, not the only way, is to have in the definition of the term company to say, or its permitted successor. Here, the original indenture that accompanied the issuance of these notes expressly authorized amendment of the indenture to define the post-merger company as the, quote, permitted successor of KCS, and that's Exhibit E to the original indenture that accompanied the notes, and that exhibit, as we cite note in our brief, is cited multiple times throughout the original indenture. The very first page of that supplemental indenture defines the company as KCS Energy, a Delaware corporation, or its permitted successor. As Vice Chancellor Strine noted on page 18, on the date of the merger, PetroHawk and the indenture trustee on behalf of the note holders signed a supplemental indenture consistent with that form, expressly defining without limitation PetroHawk as the company post-merger and the successor to KCS under the indenture. Now, we have further confirmation that the, quote, company includes the surviving entity in a merger in the very important provision, Article 5 of the indenture, which tellingly is entitled successor company. And Section 5.1 sets forth the mechanism with clear terms, the mechanism by which KCS could permissibly, quote, merge with or into another person, close quote, in a transaction in which KCS was not the surviving entity. And
my point, though, is that in order to make your argument, it's necessary to read several provisions together to get to the bottom line result.
I think it's really just the successor company provision in Section 5.1. It's an integrated document, and to adopt their position would be basically to write out of the document and throw it into an incoherent mess of a variety of provisions that clearly contemplate a merger in which KCS is not the surviving entity, but yet the surviving entity can continue, does assume the obligations, and then yet does not have to pay off the debt.
Let me follow up for a minute on Justice Jacobs' concerns. If you could have rewritten the original indenture, you would have included a definition that said specifically company means existing company and its successors.
I'm not sure I would recommend that. It would be another way to do it. I think.
Well, you know, I understand that from a lawyer's argument point of view, you know, you have what you have, and why concede that there's any better way of saying it. What would the possible downside be? Why would a drafter being told that this is what you're going to wind up with in the way of a contention and a lawsuit, why wouldn't a drafter say, oh, well, gee, I'm going to make that clear and say company means the existing company and successors? Why would somebody not do that?
There'd be no reason not to, Your Honor. I agree. It would be an additional means of, you know, a shot in the arm, so to speak. But the court's task today and Vice Chancellor Strine's task was to interpret the contract before him. And he said that the plain meaning of the contract viewed as a whole, and I can go into the other provisions that.
Okay, I understand basically your argument and that, you know, you read the contract as a whole and all of that. But again, following up on Justice Jacobs' point, if we're going to take the document as it's written and, I don't know that I should use the term strictly, but construe it exactly as written. And since there are others that specify company and its successors, and this one does not, doesn't that make for an argument, maybe not a good equitable argument, but an argument in terms of enforcing exactly what the provisions say that says, I'm sorry, your contract doesn't provide for successors.
I couldn't disagree more, because there are several places that there's a section, there's Exhibit E, which references KCS Energy or its permitted successor. There is Article 5 entitled Successor Company, and then it sets forth the way in which the company can merge with and into another entity, clearly contemplating where the new obligor will assume the obligations and things will continue as before. There's Section 11.10 titled Successors that also says that all agreements of the company, ellipsis, shall bind their respective successors. The voting stock component of the change of control definition is another place. It's on page B42. That would recognize a change of control if the company merges into another company, and there's a stock conversion component, as there was here.
Well, doesn't all that just support the point that the definition that your side is relying on is balkanized throughout the agreement rather than being contained in one single place?
I think it's contained in numerous places. I don't think it needs to be in the definitional place right up front where they define the term company, because there'd be no reason for the drafters to include a provision that where you look at the who owns a majority of the post-merger entity. If, as Vice Chancellor Strine said, if an automatic default was triggered by a change of control in which KCS was not the surviving entity, there'd be no reason to look at who owned the majority of the voting stock. It just would make no sense. The entire house of cards of the indenture would fall down. It's an integrated document that all over the place is referencing the ability of KCS to merge into another entity, and the debt will continue. With the court's permission, in my remaining time, I'd like to turn to the continuing director allegation, which is that the merger triggered a change of control under the continuing director provision, which uses familiar contractual language that's seen in analogous provisions of some employment agreements and shareholder rights plans to provide a limited contractual protection against hostile acquisitions. As the court is aware, to be considered a continuing director under the indenture, a director has to have been nominated for election or elected to the board of the company with the approval of the incumbent KCS directors. The boards of these two companies contractually agreed in a merger agreement that the board of the combined entity would have 9 members, 4 KCS designees, and 5 Petrohawk designees. There's no question, as the plaintiffs concede, that the 4 directors designated by KCS were continuing directors both before and after the merger. The argument here is that the directors who were on the pre-merger Petrohawk board and then became directors of the combined entity were never, quote, formally nominated or elected within the meaning of the requirements of the DGCL. A couple of, I think, conceded facts that the Court of Chancery noted were undisputed bear emphasis here. First, no stockholder of KCS or Petrolock has ever questioned the composition or the seating of the board. Second, there's been no contention anywhere that the merging parties seated a board that was contrary to that which KCS and Petrohawk agreed to and disclosed in the joint proxy. And third, there's no dispute that every member of the post-merger board, as the court noted before, was expressly approved by the KCS board in a unanimous pre-merger resolution. I think the Court of Chancery properly framed this New York contract law issue guided by the central objective of contract interpretation, which is to accord language its plain and ordinary meaning and to give effect to the party's reasonable expectations. In this instance, the issue was whether the post-merger board consisted of a majority of directors whose service was approved by the incumbent KCS board. There's been a lot of talk about what does technical mean, and I think it's fair to say.
Let me just interrupt you here. The choice of language and the relevant provision is somewhat interesting. It's nominated for election or elected. Is your side's position that the continuing directors were nominated for election or that they were nominated and elected? That is it one or the other or both?
I think it's both within the definition of the dictionary definition, which is the one that is required by this analysis. Very important to note, the contracting parties did not tie the phrase nomination or election to the DGCL or any specific corporate governance regime. As the Court of Chancery noted, this is a New York law indenture, and New York law calls for giving words their plain meaning. And the Court cited in a few places the dictionary definition of the word elect, which means, among other things, to make a choice or selection. I think the Vice Chancellor also correctly noted that uniform case law recognizes that the ordinarily accepted meaning of a continuing director provision is to call for an inquiry into whether the incumbent board approved a director before he or she took office. And I keep coming back to Section 5.1, but I believe that reinforces this reading because it does not preclude a merger between KCS and a surviving entity that is not incorporated in Delaware. One of the requirements is that the surviving entity be incorporated somewhere either under the laws of the United States or any state thereof, which really underscores that this is an issue of contract interpretation, not Delaware corporate law. And finally, I think really persuasively, the judge identified this as a complete, just dismantled this contention by pointing out that the Huff position would necessarily mean that any director who was appointed by the issuer's board to fill a vacancy would not be a continuing director. That's an absolutely unreasonable result that serves no legitimate interest of note holders, and I think really puts a very fine point on the technical, the whole, quote, wholly technical nature of the argument, and he used that term decided, it was decidedly in a pejorative sense. It was not in any sense that he was saying nomination or election is a technical term that must be addressed by Delaware corporate law. He absolutely said that was not the case. If the court has no further questions, I will rest at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nothing would make me happier than if the court accepted our position on both grounds. However, I recognize the fact that the court may come away with the position that there's an interpretational issue here. If there's an interpretational issue, then it was an issue that was created by the company in connection with using this indenture. And if that's the case, then any interpretational issue should be construed against the company and not against the note holders who had no part in the selection or the preparation of the indenture. There's a case that this court decided, Kaiser Aluminum versus Matheson, 681 A2D 392, which says just that in the context of a certificate of designation over preferred stock, for preferred stock. But it specifically talks in terms of standardized agreements like certificates of designation and like indentures. And it says that in appropriate circumstances, given that the issuer has the best opportunity to control the document, that interpretational issues in those circumstances should be construed against the issuer. The second point that I wanted to make, to Justice Berger's point about would the language that Your Honor suggested be better if you had to do it differently, would you do it? PetroHawk did exactly that. I had mentioned before the financing that they did in connection with completing the merger. Their July 12, 2006 indenture, 9 1/8 notes due 2016, has the definition of company that includes the successor language. One correction with respect to what Mr. McLaughlin said, more than 50% of the bondholders did not say no. There was never a vote taken on to whether to continue with this appeal. There was a majority of the bondholders who directed the trustee. We wanted the trustee to continue. The other less than 20% said no. The trustee never went to the entire bondholder issue to say, what say you? So to say that a majority of the bondholders decided not to pursue this is incorrect. Change of control, just to move to change of control employment cases, those cases are a different animal. As I said, the reason I had talked about the directors and officers agreements was that those are specifically negotiated agreements. We are talking about a different type of contract where a change of control provision has different meaning for the capital markets, and it should be interpreted with that, with those policy considerations in mind. The next point that I wanted to emphasize is that our interpretation of the change of control provision doesn't prevent mergers. It just means that there's an incremental cost to the merger. In this case, that cost would have been $2.75 million. That's the 1% on the $275 million outstanding issue. Presumably, the company would have had to do a financing for that, so they would have gone to the market and maybe had to pay a higher interest rate at the time. But it doesn't mean that the company can't merge, and it doesn't mean that the company has to pay off its entire debt. The last point that I had was with respect to the supplemental indentures. Mr. McLaughlin keeps referring to the supplemental indenture as defining KCS or any permitted successor. That was not an indenture that was signed to allow PetroHawk to succeed to the obligations. That was an indenture that is a form indenture that's used to bring on additional guarantors if KCS has another subsidiary. The indenture that was signed by PetroHawk and the trustee, KCS was not even a signatory to that indenture. That's the indenture that did have the reservations of rights language that we asked the trustee to put in so that we could enforce our change of control rights but allow the merger to go forward. That's all I have if the court has no further questions.
Thank you. The court appreciates the arguments of the parties and we'll take a brief recess and take this under consideration.